AIDS brings a response Life from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims life.
Welcome to AIDS the Lost Voices with me, William Hampson, alongside the heartfelt diary of America's own, Dave Partridge. Dave was diagnosed with AIDS in 1987. His diary, a regular fixture in Illinois' Herald and Review newspaper, sharing his journey of fear, hope and resilience, giving a voice to those often overlooked. Digits ready? Let's go. This was his personal legacy, a searing reminder of the horrors of AIDS, stated the Herald and Review newspaper of Illinois in the United States. Yet, what good is a legacy if it remains unseen in the newspaper archives? To ensure that Dave Partridge's voice resonates beyond the confines of dusty newspaper pages, his poignant diary, penned under the alias Jacob, inspired by the character from Le Cage aux Folles, serves as a powerful testament to his experiences. Born in the city of Herrin, Illinois on the 9th of December 1956, Dave was an openly gay man diagnosed with AIDS in the summer of 1987 and now found himself navigating the complexities of a life with AIDS in the city of Decatur, Illinois. His diary, a raw account of his struggles, captured the emotional and physical toll of the illness and was bravely published by Illinois' Herald and Review newspaper. Complementing each chapter of Dave's diary was the invaluable insight of Amy Ragsdale, a health journalist at the time, whose commentary provided critical context during those tumultuous years. And over the next four episodes, we will delve deeper into Dave's diary, illuminating the intersection of personal pain and broader societal issues, ensuring that Dave's legacy remains a vital reminder of resilience in the face of adversity. Now that you're up to speed, I'll let Dave, in the name of Jacob, tell you the rest. Chapter 1. Published in the Herald and Review on the 22nd of November 1987. My name is Jacob, and I have AIDS. Yes, many of you know me. I went to Washington Grade School, Neantic Harristown Junior High, and to the old Stephen Decatur High School, located where the Decatur Civic Center now stands. I'm just turning 31. I never graduated high school, but did return to Decatur to receive my GED in 1981. After leaving high school, as a 15-year-old sophomore, I spent my latter teen years and the major part of my 20s travelling from city to city, mostly southeast and north. In the last 6 years, as I came back to Decatur for short stays, I worked as a cook. I worked at the Brown Jug, the Old Dante's, Red Wheel, Howard Johnson's and McDonald's. Call it sixth sense, but about 2.5 years ago, I knew it was time to settle down and stay in Decatur. I was tired. I went to beauty school for a time and then went back to working as a cook. I was serving food at the Old Country Buffet 4 months ago when I had an accident while doing yard work that landed me in the hospital. I should have been in the hospital only a day or two, but doctors decided to keep me for tests when they noticed something wrong with my blood. I already knew that something wasn't right. The doctor came in with four large nurses to tell me that I had AIDS, but it was not necessary for me to be restrained. There was no surprise in my heart. After all, I had prepared myself for the worst. My spirit was broken, especially for those I might have unknowingly infected. I quit my job at the restaurant. In good conscience, I couldn't work around food for the public. That's the gospel truth. I could have contracted the virus in many ways. Before AIDS was heard of, I had used intravenous drugs, even manufactured them. In high school, I was a member of a group against drug use. Nevertheless, I was convinced to try IV drugs and liked them. I used IV drugs for about 5 years, but stopped because my arm began to look like it had gone through a sewing machine. Back then, bisexual and casual sex seemed to be the fashion, and I was fashionable. There were any number of ways I could have gotten it. I personally have known 6 people that have died of AIDS. I was intimate with all of them. I talked to them and watched them wither to bones, then die. They prayed for peace and a cure, as do I. I will not allow my friends and family members go through that. I have contemplated suicide. Recently, I found out that my T-cell count, a white blood cell involved in controlling the immune system, is low enough that I qualify for the drug AZT. You have to be rather bad off for that. AZT is supposed to prolong life. I worry that it might prolong the agony. I've been told never to give up hope. However, I don't see a cure in my future. I watch the tears swell in my mother's eyes when we discuss my condition. I've also been told how ashamed she is. After you lose what little family you have left, what is left but the little life you have? Chapter 2. published 6th of December 1987. I'm not a criminal, just a victim of a virus. There is no pride in my condition, only loneliness. But if anyone needs support, it is the family of an AIDS victim. When I decided to let the Herald and Review publish parts of my journal, I told my mother I was doing it. She was the only one who knew. She said if I used my real name, she'd do nothing short of moving out of the country. So, naturally, one of my greatest fears when the first part of my journal appeared was how my mother would react. I didn't call her because I thought she would hang up on me. That kind of rejection would be more than I could take. I didn't hear from my mother after the story appeared on November the 22nd. Then I wrote my mother a letter. I told her how much I loved her and that I didn't want to hurt her, but I thought my journal said things that needed to be said. The day I mailed the letter, my mother called me and we had a very pleasant conversation. It was like having a huge weight taken off my shoulders. My mother would prefer that I didn't talk so openly about my condition, but my mother is a beautiful person and is desperately trying to understand what my day-to-day life is like. My mother lives her own kind of fear. She worries that friends as well as family members who don't know I have AIDS will abandon her. My family is not responsible for the way I've lived my life. I pray to God that her friends open their hearts as well as their minds and take into consideration what my family must be going through. There is a girl in my life. I call her my girlfriend, not because we've had any sexual contact, but because she is a girl and I honestly believe her to be a friend. A week ago, she told me she has to be tested for AIDS. I took it personally and got very defensive. I had never done anything to transmit the virus to her. Later, she reminded me that she has diabetes and that a number of years ago she had a blood transfusion. The AIDS test was merely a safety check she wanted for herself. I thank the heavens the result was negative. My girlfriend is the aunt of three beautiful children. I used to babysit with them from time to time. When the children were here, we played games in the backyard so they could take off their shoes and run through the grass. The children haven't been to visit since I found out I had AIDS. I truly miss them. My girlfriend explained to me that her family likes me, but the children's grandmother is scared I might infect them. A couple of nights ago, I babysat for three other children. The children's parents are friends of mine and they know I have AIDS, but they aren't afraid to let their kids stay with me. My male companion and I live in a small cottage, so there is not a lot of running room. The kids wanted something to do, but it was cold and rainy outside, so we put up the Christmas tree. Memories flashed through my mind because we always put the tree up in early December when I was a child. I remember hanging old glass star-shaped ornaments. Now, Mother has given me a few of those ornaments for my own tree. This year, we'll spend Christmas Eve with my companion's family and Christmas with my family. I bake cookies for Christmas presents every year because I can't afford to buy gifts. This year, I'm making ginger snaps and chocolate chip and sugar cookies. When I found out I had AIDS, my conscience told me I couldn't work around food in a restaurant. So, when I left the hospital and returned to my job at Old Country Buffet, I was relieved to be told that I'd be doing clean-up work. I thought my problem was solved. I still had a job, but I wouldn't be jeopardising the public's health by serving food. I didn't tell my bosses or co-workers that I had AIDS, but they found out somehow. After that, my duties were a far cry from those I had before. I cleaned storage rooms, wiped shelving and cleaned the loading dock. People who were once friendly were now not speaking to me. When people don't understand something, they turn away, with their eyes as well as their person, so I quit. I always wondered how my co-workers learned about my illness. Last week I found out. I had confided in a friend about my illness. Apparently, he's been spreading the word. When I learned of the broken confidence, I got angry and turned to liquid peace. I really went on a drinking spree. That worked for a night, but the next few days were hell. I got a fever, I lost my appetite, I am plagued by diarrhea, but it got worse. After my drinking binge, an older and wiser friend told me, quote, "Don't go for revenge. The best way to get back at inconsiderate people is to outlive them," end quote. Oddly, I felt better. I am not the only case of AIDS in Decatur. Just the one that feels others should know the grief associated with facing a terminal illness. I worry about catching a cold or the flu. I think about the song, "I'd give a million tomorrows for just one yesterday." It was one of my favourites to play on the piano when I was a child. The song makes me think about what I would do differently if I had the chance to go back and live my life over again. Really, I change very little. I've lived a full life. Why would I want to change that? I've done more in 30 years than most people do in 60. That's the truth. On Thanksgiving Day, before I heard from my mother, I wrote what I thought would be my last entry in my journal. I just didn't think I could keep writing. I was depressed. I thought I was losing my family. Then a letter arrived at the newspaper addressed to me. It was signed, quote, "a concerned person," end quote. It touched my heart and boosted my spirit. It reminded me that I'm not writing this journal in vain. My words are helping someone understand. That's the only reason I'm doing this. Chapter 3, published on the 20th of December 1987. I'm back in the hospital. I went to see the doctor Tuesday and was admitted to Decatur Memorial Hospital. I have developed pneumonia, which is one of the illnesses often associated with AIDS. For about a week, I've had a pain in my chest, side and back. I've been coughing and had a lot of phlegm. My nights have been restless because it hurts to turn over. When I wake up in the middle of the night, my mouth is so dry that my tongue feels pasted to the roof of my mouth. I suspected something was wrong, but I didn't want to bother the doctor. Besides, I knew he'd put me in the hospital if I had pneumonia, and I didn't want to come back to the hospital. What I hate most is being stuck with needles. On the first day I was in the hospital, I got stuck 4 times because nurses needed to check my blood and find out what type of organism was causing my pneumonia. Nurses inserted a Heplock, a plug into a vein so repeated skin punctures are not necessary, but it fell out on the second day and I had to be stuck again. I'm getting medicine to ease my pain and fight the infection. I also had thoracentesis. Doctors inserted a needle through my back in between my lung and chest wall to withdraw fluid. They used Novocaine so it didn't hurt much. And I had intermittent positive pressure breathing, a therapy that helps me cough up the phlegm that's congesting my lungs. I hope to be home for Christmas, but who knows? A little more than a week ago, before this pneumonia became an issue, I began taking an AIDS drug called AZT. The white and turquoise capsules are cute. I take 2 every 4 hours around the clock. At first, I didn't have a hard time falling back to sleep when I got up to take my 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. pills, but lately the pain from the pneumonia has kept me awake. The night before I went into the hospital, I got up to take my 2 a.m. pills and then tossed and turned until 8 a.m. So far, I haven't noticed the AZT making any difference, except for the nausea, but I was warned it might be a side effect. I was worried that AZT might only prolong my pain, but when the doctor offered it, I decided to give it a chance. I can always hope. You don't actually know how precious life is until it is slowly taken away. I know there are people who think I got what I deserve, an act of God. I truly believe that God loves everyone, even those who, in others' eyes, have shortcomings. Some of our friends seem to be uneasy around us now that they know I have AIDS. Both my companion and I have been shunned. Some people don't want us around anymore. Everyone's safety has been our first priority. I think it's better to tell our friends that I have AIDS, rather than let them find out after I'm gone. Being able to share a small part of my life through this journal is helping in many ways. It's a release. I also feel like I might be helping people understand what it's like to have AIDS. A few days ago, I called a good friend. Someone I've known for nearly 19 years but haven't seen recently. He is from a conservative religious background but is more open-minded than most. When the chips were down, he was always there. Last night, for the first time, I told him I have AIDS. He was sad and angry that the disease had gotten hold of me. He started screaming and crying. I reminded him that if anybody should be mad, it should be me. But he was too upset to talk and he hung up. I called him the next morning to make sure that he was all right. I think he's handling it better now. I called my friend because I wanted him to witness my will. He witnessed the will of the man who introduced me to my companion. That man also has AIDS. To some, that may sound morbid, but a will is just one of those things that needs to be taken care of. No, I'm not down in the dumps. I just want to tie up a few things so that when the time comes, they will be done. Lately, someone asked me what I did for a sexual outlet. On a scale of 1 to 10, I am a 0. I don't have the sex drive I used to have. My engine has been put in park. I don't know if that is part of my condition or in the back of my mind a way of combating something I can no longer have. Anyway, it makes being abstinent easier than I thought it would be. A couple of years ago, if you would have told me that I could abstain from sex, I would have told you that you were nuts. The only thing worse than not having something to do is wanting to do something and not being able to. What once was an easy task like laundry is now a major project. Pulling out the portable washing machine, hooking it up and carrying wet clothes to the dryer wear me out. I'm not afraid to cry in front of anyone. Denial does nothing but cause untold grief. But I don't want others to see the hurt in my heart. If I can't be strong in front of others, how can I maintain strength for me? My companion and I received a most beautiful gift. A crocheted red and white Christmas wreath. It looks great on the fireplace mantle. The person who made the wreath is a new friend, someone I met after learning I had AIDS. There are special people in the world. Since it's nearly Christmas, I have some greetings to send. To the hospital staff and my doctor, who has a great way of saying that I smoke too much, the best of holidays. You make my stays in the hospital so comfortable. To the people who no longer feel at ease around us, we wish you the best. We are trying to limit contact. To Mary F., who has a ministry to AIDS patients, your gifts delight my taste buds and remind me how much you really care. If I had known you before I became ill, I would have been proud to help you with your work. To a regular reader, I was glad to hear that my words have helped some students better understand AIDS. And to you, the people who read my journal, I hope my words give you a new perspective about this illness. Learn and live, please. Chapter 4, published on the 3rd of January 1988. Hooray! I'm home from the hospital. I'm back in my own home where I can lounge on the couch and look down at the television instead of up. Even though Christmas is over, I still plan to bake my cookies and deliver them to friends. Better late than never. When I was admitted to the hospital on December the 15th, doctors thought I had a mild case of pneumonia and that I'd be hospitalised about a week. I was in for 2 weeks. As it turns out, I had a rare type of pneumonia. Since doctors were looking for something more associated with AIDS, my illnesses weren't easily diagnosed. Christmas in the hospital was quiet, but warm, except for the strong intravenous antibiotics that gave me chills. When I get the medicine, I get so cold I shake. Even with 5 blankets on. My mother, my stepfather, sister-in-law and my companion all spent time with me on Christmas Day. My mom brought in a miniature Christmas tree and a ceramic tree with lights. The doctors and nurses said that they were sorry I wasn't able to be home. There were Christmas carolers in the halls. They stood outside the door and sang for a while. I wish I could explain more about what happened during the time I was in hospital, but there are big blank spaces in my memory. Health journalist Amy Ragsdale of the Herald and Review newspaper that are publishing Jacob's journals is working so closely with Jacob that she offers the following insight. Edward and Jacob have been lovers for 3.5 years. Edward, 25, works as a sales clerk in a nearby town. Although Jacob has abstained from sex since finding out he has AIDS, the two men continue to share a home in Decatur. Soon after Jacob learned he had AIDS, Edward had a series of tests done to determine if he had been exposed to the virus. So far, the results have been conflicting. The following 2 instalments are from Edward's journal, where Edward writes, "When Jacob is in pain, I feel the same. When he has a good day, it makes my day good. When I found out Jacob was going to be admitted to the hospital, I felt very down. It couldn't happen again. He'd been hospitalised for shingles in mid-October. When Jacob is in hospital, my life changes a lot. I come home and no one is here. I have to cook for myself. It is very tiresome to work 8 hours and then go to the hospital. You catch yourself coming and going. One day when Jacob's illness was at its worst, I got a call about 7 a.m, right before I left for work. It was Jacob's mom, telling me that he had turned blue during the night. The oxygen level in Jacob's blood dropped to a life-threatening low, but doctors were able to make it rise again. My heart skipped a beat. I had to choose whether to go to the hospital and be with Jacob or go to work. I really wanted to be with him, but we needed money to pay the bills. I decided I had to go to work. It was the longest day that I have ever spent. I just could not get Jacob off my mind. I got off work at 5 p.m. and I went to the hospital. Jacob was very sick. They had him so doped up, I don't think he even knew I was there. I stayed until about 11 p.m. and then I had to come home. Like on most bad days, I bawled for hours. That night I couldn't sleep. All I did was roll and toss. The hardest part was seeing Jacob with all those tubes, the IVs, the oxygen, all of that. You just don't like to see tubes going into someone you care for. But I had to keep my strength up too. I didn't want to get worn down. I've had a positive ELISA test and a negative Western blot test. Two AIDS tests, the ELISA being more sensitive than the Western blot, which is used to confirm exposure to the virus. I worry about it every day. Do I have AIDS? I'm going to make an appointment with a doctor. And in his second entry, Edward writes, I've decided to keep a journal because AIDS patients' lovers need to be prepared. Maybe I can help by telling them what I'm going through. When people think about AIDS, they immediately think about the person with AIDS. They don't think about their companions, their family. We have our depression too. When I found out Jacob had AIDS, I didn't say, you're out on your own, or I'm going out on my own. I'm going to stick with it, support him as much as possible. And returning to Jacob's journal, he goes on to share, I received a letter from a 16-year-old girl. She wrote that she read about a man who lived with AIDS for 6 years. She wished me that kind of luck. Yes, I was hoping that I wouldn't get sick, but I did. I know that if my immune system were up to par, my sickness wouldn't have been so severe. Being sick definitely reminded me how vulnerable I am. I can't take being healthy or not being sick for granted. I do what I can to take care of myself. I avoid being around people who have colds. I can't afford to catch it. Stop smoking? That's later down the line. It's a habit, kind of like breathing. Being sick also made me realise there are things that can be done to make me more comfortable. Painkilling drugs as well as being around people with positive attitudes helps diminish my fear of suffering. It makes the inevitable more acceptable. When my time comes, I hope I will pass in my sleep and wake up on the other side. I'm glad I know I have AIDS because it gives me time to prepare. It's easier knowing that my time is coming than being caught by surprise. I have a pretty high threshold of pain. When I was in high school, I could make the girls go, ooh, by pushing staples into my skin. I can block out pain, like the pain in my chest from the pneumonia. That allows me to put things off, like calling my doctor when I'm sick. Dr. Wade doesn't like that at all. Emotional pain is scarier than physical pain. The first person with AIDS I knew was Tom. He was the stage manager of a Chicago theatre. I met him about 10 years ago through some friends. He didn't really want to be romantically involved with anyone, but I would go and stay with him for days at a time. He got sick in about 1979 or 1980, before AIDS was really well known. I felt really bad for him. I wasn't concerned about myself. He was the one that was sick, not me. Then there was Kevin. We met in a bar in Chicago and immediately became good friends. We lived together for several months. He ran a plant care business and was a few years younger than me. About 6 years ago, after we'd parted ways, I heard he had been sick and was in the hospital. I went to Chicago to visit him, but when I got there, I was told he had died of pneumonia associated with AIDS. I was worried about myself because I had been intimate with him, but it was not the first time I had been in that situation. After Kevin's death, I kept my eyes open for symptoms. A couple of years ago, I met Stanley at a bar in a nearby town. We ran around together, although there was never anything sexual between us. He was a bitter man. He felt deprived because he'd acknowledged his homosexuality so late in life. He was jealous of anyone having a relationship that didn't involve him. When Stanley found out he had AIDS, he went out to get all the sex he could get, while he could get it. I think that's a crime. Anyone knowingly transmitting the virus is committing murder. Stanley died a couple of years ago. He was about 50 years old. If doctors could determine where I got AIDS, would I want to know? If it would be beneficial for research purposes, sure. But just to know for my own information, it means nothing to me. I don't hold any one person accountable for my being sick. Chapter 5, published on the 17th of January 1988. Sometimes I feel like a prisoner in my own home. I'm afraid of going outside in this cold weather. The winter air really makes my lungs hurt, like a headache in my chest. Also, I don't have a lot of energy. I'm tired of being tired. I spend most of my time at home, but Every other day I go to Decatur Memorial Hospital and spend 4 hours hooked up to an intravenous pump getting medicine. I have to do this for 3 more weeks. As I write this, I'm hooked up to the pump. It's no party. I felt great one day last week, so I decided to go to the grocery store. I went to the Jewel food store in Northgate Mall. They were offering samples of pizza, and I had to have one. That triggered a desperate need to go to the bathroom. There was nothing wrong with the food. It's just the AIDS, as well as the medication I take, has had some unpleasant effects on my bowels. When the urge hit, I quickly went where the bathroom door used to be. I discovered the door was gone, replaced by a wall. I found an employee and asked, "How do I get to the restroom?" She said the nearest restroom was at Venture. I looked at her and said, "That's not very nice." I knew I couldn't make it that far. Luckily, I had given my wallet to my friend so he could pay the grocery bill while I searched for the bathroom. I dashed back to the checkout line just as he finished paying. He rushed me home, not a moment too soon. If I had known that they had changed their public restroom policy, I would have gone to another store. Isn't there a law stating that every so many square feet of space must have a public restroom? Decatur Supervisor of Inspections, Al Abbott, says grocery stores must have restrooms for their employees, but aren't required to have public restrooms. From what I've been told, my mind took a vacation when I was in the hospital last month. Seems I took a trip without leaving the farm. I was too sick and too medicated to know what was happening. Now, friends are beginning to fill in the blanks for me. I had no idea that I'd had a CAT scan, a lung biopsy, and other tests. I wasn't aware of how close I came to dying. I laugh when I'm told some of the things that I said and did. I guess there were times when I would take off my oxygen tube and put it in my ear or on my forehead. Any place but my nose. Sometimes I even put it in the garbage can with a few choice words of why it should be there. I had a dream that little green Martians would visit me. Later I told visitors I didn't want to take a nap because I might miss my Martian friends. How do I keep a sense of humour? I've been asked that often. I guess it helps to have a zest for life, love of God and precious friends. My companion, Edward, and I understand what the end will be like. There's no sadness in our home, only acceptance of reality. I'm beginning to worry less about who knows about my condition. I refuse to accept blame for the way I am or who I am. Although AIDS has been a real eye-opener, there is no way I would wish this on my biggest enemy. I'm finding it more and more important to be with people with positive attitudes rather than those who call or come to visit out of social obligation. I can see right through that. I'd rather not have them around. It takes a lot less energy for me to be positive and smile than to crawl into a corner and cry. But I've been known to do just that. There are times when the odd steam whistle needs to blow just to relieve some of the pressure. I enjoy receiving letters from people who read this journal. The mail keeps me going. I keep all of the letters and try to write a personal response to people who sign their name and provide a return address. Letters let me know that I've touched, even educated, a few people. I'm not going to preach, sing a song or dance to get my message across. I am as tired of hearing about AIDS as anybody. But maybe if I would have known years ago what I know now, then I would be reading instead of writing. Chapter 6, published on the 1st of February 1988. I have tuberculosis. I was released from Decatur Memorial Hospital on Friday after doctors spent 13 days trying to pinpoint the cause of my latest illness. I went to the hospital January the 16th for my regular every other day treatment of antibiotics. I also had a routine chest x-ray. Afterward, my doctor said my left lung, which had been infected with fungal pneumonia a few weeks ago, was clear, but there was something in my upper right lung that hadn't been there before. I had not had any pain or discomfort. From the x-ray, doctors suspected a form of tuberculosis. I was admitted to the hospital and put under respiratory precautions. That meant all my visitors were required to wear masks. On January the 22nd, doctors did a bronchoscopy by inserting a flexible tube down my nose and into my lungs. It was slightly unpleasant, even though I was numbed with Novocaine. Doctors found no signs of tuberculosis, so my visitors were allowed in my room without masks. On January 26, doctors decided to do a fine needle aspirate to get samples of fluid and tissue taken from my lungs. It was not at all the horror I thought it would be. They gave me a local anaesthetic and inserted a thin needle through my chest cavity into my lung. It was over in a couple of minutes and I had very little discomfort. The next day, doctors said they had discovered evidence of tuberculosis from the lung fluid and tissue samples. Again, the health journalist Amy Ragsdale, who's working closely with Jacob in having his journal published in the Herald and Review newspaper, shares a piece of news that Jacob receives while he's in hospital, where the article states, "Last week, Jacob learned that Edward, his companion, has been exposed to AIDS. The virus appeared in blood tests, which means Edward is likely to develop the disease. Jacob was in the hospital when Edward told him the news. There were no tears, no angry words. Both men expected this would happen." Quote, "I wished he hadn't have gotten it," Jacob said. "I think he has a lot of internal grief. I'm just going to give him emotional and moral support." End quote. Doctors don't know who Edward contracted the disease from. Jacob and Edward abstained from sex after Jacob learned he had AIDS. Quote, "And when he helped me put medicine on for my skin condition, he'd wear rubber gloves," Jacob said. "The two men expect to lean on each other now." Quote, "Edward is so work-orientated, I think he'll get bored staying at home if he gets sick," Jacob said. "But I can see us both getting up at 2 a.m. for our pills." End quote. Jacob's partner Edward shares in his own journal entry, "My test results are in. There's nothing doctors can do for me yet except let me get worse. I'm not sick enough for life-prolonging AZT or other drugs. I suspected I have AIDS. I've had diarrhea, swollen lymph nodes in my groin, fever, chills, and occasional night sweats. Lately, I just haven't been able to do things I used to. Cleaning the house is a chore. I work 8 hours a day in a drugstore, then I just want to come home and go to bed. I have this feeling in my body I just can't explain. It's kind of like being empty, like everything in my body is gone. But life will go on. I will live one day at a time and enjoy that day. I know in the future my body will do things I don't want it to do. I know it's not going to be easy, but I will make the best of it. I know some days I will not feel like doing anything, but I know what to expect. I've been through it with Jacob. That also makes it more frightening since his sickness has given me a preview of what's in store for me. So far, the hardest thing about having AIDS has been calling my family and letting them know. Telling them I was gay was hard enough. This was worse. I called my mom first. She was quiet on the phone. She said she kind of suspected it, and she urged me to take care of myself. I know she'll be there for me. I wrote to my grandparents and my dad, who live out of town. I'm not sure my grandparents will understand. They're the older generation. But if things get worse and I'm in the hospital, they might come to visit. They'll wonder why I'm sick, why there's a blood and body fluid precaution sign on my door, and why they have to wear a mask. I don't want them to feel sorry for me. I just think they ought to know before things turn worse. Sometimes, I just sit and stare into space. I think, this can't be happening to me. Returning to Jacob's journal, he goes on to state, "With AIDS being such a new disease for American doctors to treat, sharing information and experiences is vital. I've been helped incredibly by an AIDS patient that my friend Mary knows. One of the many problems associated with AIDS is loss of appetite. I can eat only a few bites of food before getting an overly full feeling. Apparently, this other AIDS patient was having the same problem. His AIDS is farther along than mine and he has started experimenting with the drugs doctors have prescribed. He learned that taking half a sleeping pill before eating lifts the overly full feeling. I told Dr. Wade about it, and he suggested I give it a try. It worked! I didn't celebrate with any big special meal, but eating is now a pleasant experience again." Gays, AIDS, gays, AIDS. These two words have become too synonymous. Now, when you hear of someone being gay, it is automatically assumed that person has AIDS, or is a carrier. It's unfair, not to mention unjust. I've read all I can about AIDS. I know scientists believe the virus may have been carried here from abroad, maybe Haiti or Africa. There, it wasn't a homosexual disease. It was labelled as a homosexual disease when it got to America. While statistics still show the majority of United States AIDS victims are homosexual men, there are heterosexual cases, some unreported and covered up. I, personally, know of one family that arranged to have a relative's cause of death listed as pneumonia. The person who died was a heterosexual drug user who contracted AIDS through dirty needles. There was no mention of AIDS on the death certificate. even though the person died of age-related pneumonia. Thank you, readers who have written to me after reading my journal. To the person who sent the wrapped gift, the pamphlets and beautiful poetry helped me more and more each day. To the great-grandmother who wrote that she would be proud to have my companion Edward and me as adopted grandchildren. We look forward to meeting you and welcoming you into our family of special friends. To the 16-year-old girl telling me to repent, pray and ask God's forgiveness, I keep my beliefs in God and Jesus close to my heart and worship in my own privacy. I too pray for the ones stricken, as well as those that believe it could never happen to them or their loved ones. To the parents who suspect they have gay children and worry about what to do, be a friend. Be open and honest with your children. Don't attack what you may believe to be wrong, but approach them with love and honest communication. To Rachel, the best advice I can give you is to contact your nearest health department and make an appointment for an AIDS test. You never give your name, but you are assigned a number. There is no cost. They will be able to answer the questions I'm not qualified to answer. Best of luck. To all of you who ask questions about AIDS, information is out there. All you have to do is request it. The Mason County AIDS Task Force would be a good place to start. The task force, formed in September, has been criticised for keeping a low profile. For more information about the task force or its programmes, contact the Mason County Health Department. Quiet time is over, task force. Chapter 7, published on the 22nd of February, 1988. I'm ready to pop like a volcano, but I don't have the energy. I'm just sitting around and rotting. I haven't shaved in so long people think I'm growing a beard. Actually, that's not a bad idea. It might fill in the hollow spots. I know I've lost more weight. I can't eat. When I do, I can't keep the food down. I don't have a scale. I wish I did. No, I don't. It would just make me worry. What I need to do is sit down and have a big, healthy cry. Maybe break a few plates. But I hate crying because my tears are orange. The tuberculosis medicine makes my tears, sweat, urine and bowel movements orange. At least it doesn't stain. Oh, I'm depressed. And to top it off, I've been sick for about a week. Cramps, vomiting, diarrhea, no energy, no appetite. It's just like the intestinal flu, but more amplified because of the AIDS. I feel like I'm travelling down a hopeless road and the AZT, a life-prolonging drug, just postpones the inevitable. I feel I'm trying to roller skate uphill. I haven't had a good day in over a week. My twice-a-day nap is now 3 and 4 times a day. I've been so sick I haven't been able to drink liquor. That ought to tickle my doctor, James Wade III. If I have another spell, if I have to go back into hospital, take more antibiotics, I think I might commit suicide. I don't have any intention of prolonging my agony to appease anybody else. Yes, I'm still taking the AZT pills. I've also been taking my tuberculosis pill. The mysterious pain in my lower right side has disappeared, but the tuberculosis pill kind of makes my stomach queasy. I'm sick of taking pills. I change my AZT schedule so I take the pills at noon, 4 p.m, 8 p.m, midnight, 4 a.m, and 8 a.m. I just automatically wake up for the 4 a.m. pills. I don't even set an alarm anymore. With this flu, I just generally wake up and have to run to the bathroom anyway. I don't even sleep in my bed anymore. I sleep on the couch. That's not because I'm mad at Edward, but because I toss and turn a lot. He doesn't get any sleep if I'm in the bed, and he's edgy enough without being kept awake all night. I'm edgy too. There's tension building between me and my mom, who lives a few blocks away, and between me and Edward. I'm stuck in this fucking house. When I've got a little bit of energy, I don't have any way to get out. When there's someone around to take me out, I don't feel like doing anything. Then, when I get out to the grocery store, Mom says, "You shouldn't be out in the cold." I've been arguing with Edward because he wants to see my will and I don't want to show it to him. I don't think its contents are going to make him mad. It's just the principle of the thing. I feel that a will is a very personal, confidential document. It isn't for anybody's eyes until it's needed. I slept through Valentine's Day. Edward bought me a little red stuffed devil that's holding a sign that says, "I love you." What did I get Edward? A big hug. Lately, I haven't been able to get out of the house to get anything else. When I got out of the hospital at the end of January, I was feeling great. I'd had my batteries recharged. I felt so great, I painted the bathroom. It was pink. Now it's blue. And I made curtains. White with candy cane blue striped ruffles and valance. We got new towels and a matching shower curtain. A friend gave me a plaque that says, "This is to certify that the repainting of one said bathroom has won the approval of the board of directors of the Decatur branch of the Good Housekeeping Corp." Why do all this work? Edward and I have discussed what to do with our property when we're both gone. I said I'd like to sell everything and have the proceeds go to AIDS research. I figure by improving the house, we'll increase its market value. One day, when I was feeling good, I went to Woolworths looking for bathroom fixtures for our remodelled bathroom. While I was there, I got an aquarium. I can stare at it and there's never a commercial. I always had aquariums when I was growing up, but I haven't had one in years. A couple of times I've bought one at a rummage sale, but I usually ended up giving it to some kid. After I got the aquarium going, I went out and got fish. A beta, a couple of goldfish, lyretail mollies, three green swords, and a barbed tetra. The two female green swords are pregnant. I guess the male has been working overtime. Our cat was jealous of the fish at first. We were giving them a little more attention than the cat. Our cat's name is Sylvia. We thought it was female, but when we took it to be fixed, the veterinarian called us and said, "Sylvia is really Sylvester." After the cat was fixed, we figured it really didn't matter, so we kept calling it Sylvia. My mother gave Sylvia to us, to Edward, that is, even though Edward and I discussed and decided we wouldn't have pets. I'm sick of the damn cat. I'm tired of hairballs. Whenever you get up, the cat takes your seat. I'm constantly moving it. It's a fair weather cat. When the weather's fair, it's outside. Otherwise, it's indoors. I heard that it may not be healthy to have pets when you have AIDS. Disease-causing organisms can thrive in pets' waste products. So, a person with AIDS runs a risk in cleaning litter boxes, petting a dirty animal, etc. I guess I'm not really as concerned as I should be. A woman named Bev wrote to me about 6 weeks ago. She asked if I liked to read and I said, "Yeah, but I don't do much of it because it gives me headaches." I've heard that AIDS can make your eyes weaker. I don't know if they are weaker, but I think my hearing has gotten sharper. Anyway, Bev called me back and wanted to know if I'd be interested in getting glasses. I'm supposed to wear glasses, but I don't have any. I can't afford them. I told her, yes, if I had glasses, I would wear them. She gave me the address of a man in a service club that helps needy people get free eyeglasses. I wrote to him, but I haven't gotten a response yet. Bev doesn't call me very often because she's afraid of being a nuisance. I appreciate that. I should call her more, I suppose. Last week, she brought me a couple of lobster tails. Oh, they were fabulous. I bought an answering machine so I could get my rest.
Please leave a message after the tone.
People do not understand that it's more important for me to have my rest than to answer the telephone and have a nothing conversation. But some of my friends are intimidated by the machine. Now the phone doesn't ring anymore. Chapter 8, published on the 6th of March, 1988. Life is a bowl of cherries, complete with pits and a couple of green worms. Last time I wrote the journal, I was in the pits. I was sick and depressed. Now, I'm right next to the fruit. Life is looking up. I feel better. I got my car worked on, paid some bills, and I got rid of the cat. My mood has improved because I feel like I've accomplished some things. Believe me, anything is an accomplishment when you don't have the energy to do a whole lot. Sometimes, cleaning out the refrigerator is a milestone. Having a car again makes me feel like a bird with new wings. I'll go visit friends, shop when I want to. Just being able to get out of the house will put me in a better frame of mind, I think. I have a 1967 Chevy that's been sitting in the driveway since March 1987, when I drove up on a parking embankment and put holes in the oil pan. The car also needed new shocks. Until now, the car wasn't drivable. Besides, I haven't always had the energy to drive a stick shift. Earlier this week, I got a check for more than $600, back payments from Social Security. It was such an unexpected treat. Besides the car repairs, I'm going to finish paying the power bill, the rest of the phone bill, and repay some people I owed money. Social Security is my only regular means of support. I get about $300 per month. By the time I take care of necessities, there's not a whole lot left over. Edward, my companion, and I take turns paying $200 monthly house payments and the electric, gas and phone bills. Who pays depends on who has the money when the bill is due. Now watch, I'll get a letter from Social Security tomorrow saying we want our money back. I went to the doctor for a regular appointment 2 weeks ago. I took off my shirt to be examined, and Dr. James Wade III said, "Where are you going?" I didn't know what he meant. He said I'd lost too much weight. I am vanishing. I've lost about 52 pounds since the AIDS was diagnosed in August. I'm down to about 137. My clothes fit loosely. The underwear I got for Christmas hangs on me like rags on a clothesline. I try to wear bulky clothes because they make me look like I haven't lost so much weight. I eat about a third of what I used to eat. I start getting nauseous if I eat too much. If I stop eating, I'm able to keep the food down. My appetite varies. I usually want what I don't have. But all in all, I feel pretty good. I take my AZT every 4 hours and I take my tuberculosis medicine once a day. I have sporadic energy. Sometimes when I take a nap, I wake up feeling pretty chipper. Other times, I want to nap some more. In this chapter, we also hear from the health journalist Amy Ragsdale, who gives us an insight into an article that had been written about Jacob earlier in the week, where she states, "Last week, Herald and Review editor Thomas L. Blount wrote a column about the mail Jacob has received since he began sharing his journal. Blount referred to Jacob's lack of formal education. Jacob dropped out of high school but later earned a GED, a high school equivalency diploma. While reading Blount's column, Jacob paused and commented on the part about his schooling, where Jacob in his journal goes on to share, "When I was growing up, I wanted to be a veterinarian. My parents wanted me to be a musician. I liked everything about school except physical education and maths. I quit because school was such a violent place to be. I went to the old Stephen Decatur High School. I remember stabbings, desks being thrown from windows. I felt out of place. I dropped out of school at 15 and went to stay with my sister in Missouri. Then I started travelling. Being young, gay and good looking took me places. I went to Hollywood, to the Fontainebleau in Miami, places some people around here only dream of going. I don't have the kind of education that anyone has been able to describe with a diploma. I have a degree in life, but there is nothing I can't do. The only thing that limits me is saying I can't. It's the same for anybody. When I was in the hospital and found out I had AIDS, sex became a notion of the past. Why? Responsibility. Would you want to hold a gun to someone's head and pull the trigger, then take the gun and shoot your victim's parents and the people who love him? That's how I feel a lot of times about what has happened to my family. Although I stopped having sex with Edward when I learned I had AIDS, I encouraged him to have an outside relationship. After all, he's young and virile, and I thought it would help us maintain our relationship. After Edward learned in late January that he had been exposed to the AIDS virus and might develop the disease, we had sex. Twice. We practiced safe sex. There was penetration, but we used condoms. It was boring. Now Edward and I have stopped having sex again. We've decided safe sex is just not the same. And we've learned that repeated exposure to me can multiply the virus in his body because my sickness is more advanced than his. My relationship with Edward has changed from being companions to being virtually nothing more than roommates in a one-bedroom house. Our new problem? Edward and I disagree about whether it's okay for him to have safe sex with others now that he too is infected with the AIDS virus. I don't think it is. For gay men, safe sex often means using condoms, but I think safe sex is for people who don't already know that they've been exposed to AIDS and want to protect themselves and their partners. Even safe sex is not foolproof. Accidents do happen. Edward thinks I feel this way because I'm abstaining and don't want him to have sex with anyone else. I'm not that selfish. I thought seeing what I'm going through would change his mind, but he seems to think that safe sex makes it impossible for him to transmit the disease. I've tried to explain that one slip-up could mean the end for his partner. Unfortunately, when an accident does happen and someone contracts AIDS, it's a slow and grueling process for the victim and his family. I have picked up my reading glasses. I'm looking forward to seeing what I've been missing. A local service club helped me get the glasses. I tried on a lot of pairs. I don't know how long I spent. Finally, I went to Wiser Eye Care and chose bifocals with clear plastic frames. I want to thank the service club, even though the group doesn't want to be mentioned by name, and let them know the glasses will be used a lot. Sylvia the cat is back home with my mother, who gave us the pet about 2 years ago. She seems a lot happier there. I don't blame her. She's spoiled rotten. Of course, she wasn't doing that bad here. Sylvia went back about 2 weeks ago, shortly after I wrote my last journal. In the end, getting rid of Sylvia was a mutual decision. My health seems to have improved since the litter box is gone. Having a small house, the litter box was always under my nose. I don't know if there are actually physical reasons that I feel better or if it's psychological. My mom doesn't have any other pets and she's happy to have Sylvia back. I went to visit recently and the cat was all over me, like a long lost friend. Drove me crazy. Some of you have written to me and asked me not to commit suicide. I believe most people who commit suicide are healthy but unhappy about something that could be worked out with prayer and patience. But when you're faced with a terminal illness, things come into a different light. I don't think the word suicide fits if you're talking about a terminally ill person who is hurting. When you're dying, you hang on for as long as you can comfortably and then you crave a release. A release for yourself and others who care for you. I've seen what AIDS does to its victims. When I start to look so pitiful that people become ill looking at me, it is time. I'm going to die anyway. I don't think taking my own life would be a sin, but rather salvation from pain and grief. If and when I do it, I think I will be able to look at my God and feel no guilt, shame, or sin for my action. Chapter 9, published on the 21st of March, 1988. I'm tired of AIDS being the subject of my life. Pretty much everyone wants to talk to me about AIDS. And people think all I ever want to talk about is AIDS. It's out of curiosity and concern. It's no one's fault, it's just nature. Well, I don't want to talk about AIDS all the time. My doctor, James Wade III, knew of a doctor with AIDS who tried to keep a journal but learned that writing can go from being a release into being a pressure. I have to think of things to write about and things not to write about. I write something and then the next minute I read it and I think it means something else. I worry about what someone else will think. My goals and purpose for doing this journal are to reach out to other people and relieve some of their fears about AIDS, as well as the fears of others who might have the disease, and possibly to answer some questions left unanswered. I want to provide things that books don't have. There's a big difference between reading about AIDS and knowing someone who has it. Because they've read my journal, some people have started to feel like they know me. At least that's what my mail says. But I feel like I need to go on with my life and not always surround myself with constant thoughts of AIDS. I'm reminded of that enough every 4 hours when I take my medicine. I like reading things about AIDS research. I'll read anything I see, but I don't go out of my way looking for material. I really liked a book called The AIDS Cover-Up by G. Antonio. It's a very informative book that alleges government officials have known about AIDS for a long time. The book says AIDS isn't new, but it was just kept under wraps. As far as seeing so much about AIDS in the media, I'm pretty numb to it. It doesn't bother me. I've been on a feeling good, feeling bad rollercoaster. About every 3 days, I have a spell of feeling bad. Vomiting doesn't even bother me anymore. I'm so used to it now, it's old hat. I went a couple of weeks and didn't nap at all. Here, lately, that's all I've wanted to do, and that's all I've done. Even so, I'm worn out all the time. Standing and walking are the biggest energy eaters. I feel like I need a wheelchair to get me around the damn house. They're trying to fatten me up. The Ensure chocolate pudding is an unappetizing grey, but it's potent. The pudding comes in these cans that are smaller than snack pack pudding cans. By the time you eat about half of it, it's like you ate about a dozen snack pack puddings. I haven't had any problems keeping it down, but it's going to take some getting used to. Sometimes I think it's like eating bathtub cold conceal. Ugh. I'm hoping to rent out a tip-out camper for a weekend this spring or summer. I can't hike anymore, but I still enjoy the outdoors. I was raised camping. My family went to Yellowstone and all sorts of state parks. Once, at Yellowstone, we had a bear raid the camp next to us. The people had a cooler on the picnic table, even though rangers tell you to keep your coolers locked in the car. This bear just walked over and smacked the cooler on both ends, and the lid flew off. A man came out of the tent and chased the bear up a tree by saying, "Shoo, bear." Then the bear came down the tree and chased the man into an outhouse. Finally, the bear wandered off. Oh, it was funny. People with AIDS are not monsters. It's much easier to get a lot of other illnesses than it is to get AIDS. When you are terminally ill, you treat life with new respect. You get a new outlook, and you treat the time you have much more cautiously. Chapter 10, published on the 1st of May 1988. I've been on a sabbatical. A sabbatical is a rest to take time off to improve yourself. I'm taking things a little easier. I've taken time to think things out. I've just slowed down, stopped pushing myself. It has been a month since I wrote my last journal. Time has flown by. It's been busy. I now have my own apartment. Edward and I parted ways. He had been my companion for 3 years. Edward is HIV positive. That means he's been exposed to the AIDS virus, but is not yet classified as having the disease. And he's relatively new to the gay scene. He felt like he needed new experiences, and it was draining me emotionally knowing what was going on. I didn't like the idea of him being HIV positive and having sex. Even using condoms, there isn't absolute protection. I thought he was risking infecting somebody else, and I was beginning to feel like I'd been put in the back seat. He would bring home some of the men he was dating, and I'd meet them. It made me feel lonely. Some nights he wouldn't come home at all. Sometimes his dates-to-be would call. I could hear him talking to them. How would that make you feel? For a while, there was hope that we could live together as just friends. That wouldn't work, though. How many women could live with their ex-husbands? Or vice versa? So, I decided to get my own place. Edward has moved out of town. We're trying to sell the house. We're having yard sales the next 2 weekends to sell the old Christmas decorations, clothing and kitchen stuff. The only reason Edward and I didn't have a big fight is because I don't drink like I used to. He knows better than to tangle with me when I'm sober. Our parting was very cool. We didn't fight or argue, we just said goodbye. My final note on AIDS and relationships. When one partner is more ill than the other, it becomes a true test of the relationship. Some may make it and some may not. I'm so relieved it's over between Edward and me that I'm not sad. I tried living alone only once before. That's when I lived in Champagne, but I was always going out to the bars because I couldn't stand being by myself. It will be different this time. I'm on sidelines of life now. I'm looking forward to the privacy of living alone. I won't be interrupted by anyone I don't want to be interrupted by. I can put up my sewing machine and I won't have to put it away. I'll probably make some summer pants and shorts. Some lounging wear. I don't like eating alone though. I usually try to find a friend to eat with me. I usually cook. It's cheaper than eating out. I don't know how my family feels about me living alone, but I've got a phone in case I need help or get sick in the middle of the night. In fact, I was nauseous and vomiting a couple of nights ago. I went too long without eating and took my medicine on an empty stomach. I didn't call for help. I just went to bed. By the next morning, I was better. Did I tell my new landlord I have AIDS? No. I tell people about my medical situation, only if I think they would be comfortable with it. I don't want to harm anybody. I just want to live a peaceful life. Since my last journal, I've had 2 blood transfusions to increase my hemoglobin. Your hemoglobin carries oxygen to the brain. It's a quick way to recharge my batteries without a long visit in the hospital. I get the transfusions in the same day surgery department. It takes 5 to 6 hours. The blood is on an intravenous drip. I watch TV and nap during it. I usually feel refreshed afterwards. Except for the last time, which came right in the middle of my breakup with Edward. I was under a lot of emotional stress. Afterwards, I felt like nothing had been done. Ever since I signed the lease to my new apartment, I've been feeling great. My tuberculosis is all gone. It took 3 months to get rid of it. I still take the medicine, though, as a safety precaution. I don't know how long I have to keep taking it. What's another pill or two, anyway? And I've been holding my weight. In fact, I think I might have gained a little. I'll find out in a few weeks when I go back to the doctor. I haven't particularly been eating well, though. I've been munching on candy and chips. Actually, I'm supposed to munch because it helps hold my weight. Before, my doctor, James Wade III of Decatur, was very concerned about my emotional state because it was dragging me down. It was lowering my immune system. Now that the situation with Edward is over, I feel better emotionally and physically. Dr. Wade is going to be amazed at what I've accomplished. I'm amazed at what I've accomplished. All in all, my move went well, but the dwarf frog in the aquarium didn't like the move at all. At first, I thought a fish ate him, but I found Fergie bobbing along the top of the water. My aquarium now has 16 fish and Fergie. I look for Fergie once a day to make sure the fish don't eat him. They eat each other, so I would imagine they would try to eat a little helpless frog. Know anybody in the market for a cornet? I used to play. I made it sound like a moose that's just been shot. I guess I'll put it in on the yard sale. A few weeks ago, I accepted an invitation to talk to a charity group here in Decatur. I thought it was great that they were so concerned about AIDS. I was accompanied by Amy Ragsdale. She started the talk with a brief explanation of how we came to meet. Then we opened it up to questions. I thought Amy and I made a damn good team. The group consisted mostly of middle-aged men. I really didn't expect them to be afraid of me. After all, they requested that I talk to them. It wasn't as if I just went. A number of the members had not read my journal. Their questions were honest and true. They were very curious about how long I have to live. I explained that I am already living on borrowed time. Doctors have told me there are 5 stages of AIDS, with the 5th stage being death. I am moving into the 4th stage. The meeting, which was supposed to take an hour, lasted nearly an hour and 20 minutes. Afterward, about 6 of them stayed to ask questions. I was happy to see there was an outreach for information in Decatur. I wish they'd have us back again. Several of the men shook my hand. One of the members even bought me a cocktail. I didn't detect any fear. None. In the next episode, Dave explores blood transfusions as a rejuvenating treatment. He starts a vegetable garden for fresh produce and a therapeutic escape. And while replying to fan mail, he forms new friendships and even fires off a letter to the President of the United States. 2 fake hits and Dave finds a shortage of dentists willing to treat someone with AIDS, along with a brush with Kaposi sarcoma, and an unexpected whirlwind romance. You can check out and read all the newspaper articles mentioned in this episode, along with extra snippets of information, on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, then don't forget to like, share and subscribe. Until the next episode, you can find me on Instagram at The Lost Boys of Soho.